This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega.
We all should be able to agree that in the United States of America, we will not intentionally separate children from their parents. We will not do that. We are better than that.
That is the unmistakable voice of the late Congressman Elijah Cummings, speaking in 2018 during a meeting of the House Oversight Committee, convened to discuss the Trump-era policy of separating minor children from their families at the southern border. And as a civil rights activist and the son of sharecroppers, I suspect the late Representative Cummings knew that his assertion of America being, quote,
better than that,
was more aspirational than factual. Indeed, our national history is replete with examples of willful separation of children from their parents.
I was sold first to Ben Davis, a slave trader, and my daughter was sold to a stranger. I fell on my knees before Mr. Davis and begged him to buy my daughter from this stranger. His heart must have been touched by my agony because he walked over to the stranger and offered to buy my patience. But the stranger refused to sell her. And he went away a few hours later. I have never seen my daughter since.
That's the voice of a young actor performing a true story as part of a program titled Last Scene, which was staged in February 2019 by Villanova University's Departments of History and Theater. She's reading one of the thousands of information wanted ads taken out by formerly enslaved people who were forcibly separated from their families during American slavery. These ads show that even decades after families were scattered by the sale of human beings as chattel, people still wondered about, yearned for, and searched for their loved ones. In 1941, Nikki Nojima Lewis saw her father arrested by FBI agents during her fourth birthday party. He was guilty only of being a Japanese immigrant. And after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, tens of thousands of Japanese American families were separated and incarcerated across the American West. Nikki Nojima Lewis spoke about her experience in a 2019 interview with New Mexico Public Television.
You know, I've had a childhood in camp. My father was taken away and was with my mother in a concentration camp in Minidoka, Idaho, in the desert of Minidoka, Idaho, one of 10 war relocation authority camps.
19th century separation of enslaved families, 20th century separation of Japanese American families, 21st century separation of migrant families. All rest on a brutal government practice which for more than a century forcibly removed hundreds of thousands of indigenous children from their parents, families, and tribes in both the U.S. and Canada. These children were taken to so-called boarding schools to be stripped of their language, culture, traditions, and identities through a policy of forced assimilation. And like the newly emancipated who took out newspaper ads for their loved ones, the families and communities of these Indigenous children have never ceased yearning and searching. Last week, U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced a new initiative to investigate the, quote, loss of human life and the lasting consequences of this practice of family separation.
I know that this process will be long and difficult. I know that this process will be painful. It won't undo the heartbreak and loss that so many of us feel. But only by acknowledging the past can we work toward a future that we're all proud to embrace.
That was Secretary Haaland addressing a virtual conference of the National Congress of American Indians last week. The U.S. government's announcement follows similar efforts in Canada, which resulted in the discovery of the remains of 215 Indigenous children buried outside a boarding school in British Columbia, as reported in late May. And in recent days, another 751 unmarked graves were found near the site of a former school in Saskatchewan. Overall, an estimated 6,000 children died at schools in Canada. And according to government officials, many of the children were physically and sexually abused. If we are to be
better than that,
as Representative Cummings believed we could be, then we must begin by facing and addressing what happened here. And we begin here with Nick Martin, staff writer for The New Republic and member of the Saponi tribe. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Talk to me about why. Why are we now seeing an initiative like this in the U.S.?
Well, I think there are probably a couple of reasons as to why this moment. First and foremost being that Deb Haaland is the Secretary of the Interior. Deb Haaland is a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo and is the first Native official to be appointed to a cabinet position in United States history. I mean, so her presence in the interior, which oversaw many and funded many of these schools, cannot be overstated. And I wrote in a column this past week in the New Republic, kind of pointing this out, both as a measure and a testament to Secretary Haaland's obviously overwhelming support for tribal consultation and listening to what tribal communities need, but it is also an indictment of, I think, every interior official who came before her in a leading position that chose not to take similar action. This is something, as you mentioned, Canada has kind of undergone this already with their Truth and Reconciliation Committee from 2008 to 2015. They're a little bit ahead of the ball on this. We're just starting. So it's going to be a long road, but I think Deb Haaland's presence is first and foremost why we're seeing this happen. In addition, I think the political news around the recent discoveries, both in Canada as well as in the U.S., you're talking close to or over 1,000 Indigenous children's remains being found within a month. So I think that also obviously maybe spurred to action plans that were already in place. I think those are kind of the news in addition to Secretary Haaland's position, I think are the main reasons we're seeing so much action on this right now.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of these boarding schools, how they came to be, maybe beginning with the Civilization Fund Act of 1819?
You have to frame it within the broader context of colonization in the United States. Much of the efforts of colonization were a little bit more disparate to start and weren't quite as organized. So what you saw, a lot of the conditions that we can maybe get into here in a second, were kind of formed more in these missions that would be run, church run, or in these forts, which would be a combination of church and whatever European government, or eventually would turn into the American government being run. And the idea behind these missions and forts were varied, but the overarching design for those was to kind of slowly begin to extract the culture and the language from Indigenous people and assimilate them. But it wasn't done in quite an industrialized fashion because Indigenous nations remained very strong Indigenous nations, which they do today as well. I think the problem was that after westward expansion, kind of through the mid-19th century, the United States started really taking a hard look at they actively wanted to remove tribal nations as political entities. And as many colonizing forces have done over the years, they recognize that the fastest way to that is to go through the children. And so you started with the first, kind of official federally run boarding school being the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, which operated, 1879 to 1918. And then that kind of kicked off a much larger expeditious trend by the United States government, and Canada was also doing its thing at the same time. And ultimately by the end of it, I think we had close to over 350 boarding schools by this time it was said and done in the 1980s and 1990s when they finally transitioned fully into these current Bureau of Indian Education schools that are still operating today.
Pause. They're still operating today.
Yeah. So when I say that, I don't mean that they're operating in the same function, but many of the same exact school grounds and school facilities have been repurposed by the Bureau of Indian Education, which by, you know, treaty and trust responsibility, along with things like the Indian Health Service, you know, it is one function of the federal government to provide education for tribal communities.
So talk to me just a bit about what the experience was like for children in these schools under that sort of more oppressive regime that we've just been talking about.
Yeah. And I want to be really careful here. We are talking about things that happened in the 19th century, but these also happen. There are people alive today who went through these schools, who live with, you know, active scarring emotionally, spiritually, physically, because of the conditions at these schools. So, you know, I don't want to be overly gratuitous or anything disrespectful towards those experiences. And I think this is maybe more of a meta commentary than anything, but I do think that, you know, like I said earlier, Canada is probably over a decade ahead of us on this. And just in terms of trying to build some sort of public acknowledgement of just how horrific these schools were for the children that were forced to go there. And you're talking in the thousands, tens of thousands. And it was very mechanical. And that's where I get when I'm faced with a question of describe what happened there. I foresee over the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be lots of opportunities, I think, for living survivors to mm-hmm. tell their stories in more prominent ways and be given the platforms that they deserve. These were places where the children's well-being was the absolute last thought on the list. These were not schools. They could even call them, mm-hmm. like, we use this term, and Canada uses residential schools, we call them boarding schools. The problem that we're going to face over the coming years, I think, and this is something we face a lot with just, you know, basic, I think, language impediments, which is that if you talk to most Americans and you ask them about boarding schools, and you just left it at that, their mind is going to some Northeastern prep school to feed into an Ivy League mm-hmm. or something like that. And if you ask any Indigenous person, like, you're getting a completely different reaction. So I think that terminology, you know, boarding school is so light as to what happened there. I mean, these are places where children were literally sold out for free labor to nearby farms and factories, where they were, you know, had their hair cut, they had their language stripped from their mouths, or they were physically reprimanded. Like, these were things, and much, much worse. I think that we're going to, you know, just as I kind of take a step out of my body here and look from 30,000 feet, I do think, you know, as we move forward and we try to get into facing the truth of what happened at these schools, we're also going to have to face the truth of how to communicate that to a public that just doesn't have a clue of the recency of it, but also to the extent of how, like, designed it was to do its specific function, which was not be a school. It was to be a place of assimilation and cultural genocide. And those are really, you know, I mean, especially genocide is a strong word, but that is what this is a part of. This is how you politically erase a people. And that is what the mission was. And so I think as we get into discussing the conditions, the terms, the history of it, we also have to keep in mind that it is a present history, and just be cognizant that, you know, someone out there might be listening, went through this experience, and I just want to be respectful of them and anybody else who does these kind of, you know, subsequent media coverage, as they should. And I'm so thankful that y'all are doing it. I just hope that everybody can kind of keep that in mind.
What is this review going to entail?
So it's broken down into several phases. And again, we're functioning off of a 3-page document at the current moment. So I think we'll get much more kind of details as to what a full-throated review will consist of in the coming months. But essentially their goal is to really create a full database of information from survivors, from tribal nations, from these boarding schools. So much of the information that was out there regarding enrollment regarding whose child was sent where. I mean, that is information that is largely, you know, out in the ether. I mean, there's no kind of unified sense of being able to connect, because right now we're, like I mentioned earlier, Carlisle Industrial Indian School, it is in the process of disinterring and returning the remains of children who died and were buried in its graveyard. And which, you know, the school, many of these schools had dedicated graveyards because of just how many children they would lose. And, or I guess rather, you know, I think you could go as strong as say kill. And the idea here for the interior is to really kind of connect and unify all of this information that is out there in a way that allows, I think, some grieving and some closure to be found for families, both in terms of having the remains either be returned or be set in a way that is more respectful of their spirits and their families. I think also the idea is to allow tribal nations to really lead the way on what is appropriate here. So you're going to be featuring lots of talks between interior officials and you know, appropriate tribal government officials over the coming months in terms of how do we actually set forth a series of goals or recommendations or policies that the federal government or the state government or the tribal government need to undertake in order to, I think, one, be able to rectify, or not even rectify the situation, but just be able to reach some sense of justice, I think. And right now, these are like kind of vaguer terms that I'm using because we're not quite sure what the endpoint of this review is going to be. It's going to be produced by April of next year. But beyond that, you know, the details of what it actually include, we can kind of only, you know, infer based on what Canada has done, and then also just kind of look at what the available options for the interior are to do within a year. Because a year is not a very long time to, I think, put together this information. I think it'll ultimately end up being a much larger, longer project.
So you've talked a couple of times about us being sort of a decade behind Canada, also sort of pushed by Canada and some of the recent findings there. How is the Canadian process different than the process that the U.S. seems to be embarking on here?
I think it was, part of the problem that, you know, Indigenous people face in the United States is oftentimes, you know, a numbers game. And the truth is that, you know, in the Indigenous populations in Canada are just a much higher percentage. And so their ability to bring public awareness to this issue, you know, just came about, I think, just on a faster time scale, as well as, you know, their ability to then influence. You had people like Murray Sinclair and these people who are actually, you know, senators and sitting members of the federal government, which, you know, I mean, when Deb Holland left the House to take over the Secretary of Interior's role, our number of Native people in Congress went, I think, from like five to four, but then we got two more in the House this year. So it did kind of end up balancing out. But my point being that it's very low. And so the ability to kind of do what is necessary in those, you know, committees and subcommittees and use them as kind of platforms to bring to light issues that, you know, for Indigenous people have never been brought to light fully. It has not really been there for us in the U.S. And so, and this is also a testament to the organizing and hard work of not just government officials in Canada, but all, I think, of their, like, the Indigenous governments and communities have worked like supremely hard to ensure that Canadians of all stripes recognize what happened at these places. And that's what's happening with Secretary Holland and her team at the interior now. You work with what you have. And right now, you know, in a sense, we have the interior. We have this massive federal agency with somebody on top of it who truly cares. So I think that you have to leverage that moment. And that is also why you're seeing this boarding school initiative, because it's something, like I said earlier, like, we're long overdue for this, and I think Secretary Holland recognizes that as well.
Nick Martin is a staff writer for The New Republic and a member of the Saponi tribe. Nick has reminded us today that history matters, language matters, and representation matters. Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. On Friday, Minneapolis Judge Peter Cahill sentenced former police officer Derek Chauvin to 22 and a half years for the murder of George Floyd. Chauvin's mother addressed the court prior to the sentencing. She described her son as a good and caring person, asked the judge for leniency, and despite bystander video showing Officer Chauvin kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes, she expressed her staunch belief in her son's innocence. Then she addressed her son directly, telling him this.
Remember, there is no stronger bond or love than a mother's love.
Mother love. You can hear the mother love in the voice of Tamika Palmer as she spoke to NBC News about her daughter, Breonna Taylor, who was slain in March of 2020 by a team of Louisville, Kentucky police officers while she lay sleeping in her own bed.
Breonna was just full of life. She didn't deserve it. She was 26 years old.
Mother love. You can hear Samaria Rice's mother love as she speaks to TheRoot.com in June of 2020 on what should have been the 18th birthday of her son, Tamir Rice. Instead of reaching adulthood, Tamir Rice was killed by Cleveland police officers in November 2014 as he played in a park near his home. He was 12 years old. 12.
I am tired and I am numb because what law enforcement has done to my family, I'm not able to have no enjoyment out of life, for real. So I've been in counseling, also known as Tamir's murder, and it's going to be an ongoing thing because I suffer with PTSD in the most severe way, the most severest form. It's almost like I've been in a war.
Mother love. It is mother love that pierced the soul of Sabrina Fulton when she saw the video of Officer Derek Chauvin murdering George Floyd. Her own son, Trayvon Martin, was only 17 years old when George Zimmerman shot and killed him as he walked home from the store carrying only Skittles and an iced tea. Here, Sabrina Fulton speaks to ABC News back in June of 2020.
I've been on a roller coaster. I've been up and down. It's been times where I just cried when I heard George Floyd yell out for his mother. I cried because I imagine, you know, me being his mother or my son being there and calling out for me, and I wasn't able to help him and he wasn't able to help himself.
Mother love. It is mother love that robs Leslie McSpadden of her voice in November 2014 as she learns the grand jury will bring no charges against the Ferguson police officer who shot and killed her son, Michael Brown. And even as crowds chant and national media cameras roll, she is left only with the anguish of tears. And her agony is the reminder that while a mother's love is unbreakable, mothers ourselves can break. No one has been charged for Breonna Taylor's death. No one has been charged for the death of Tamir Rice. George Zimmerman was acquitted for killing Trayvon Martin. No one has been charged for the death of Michael Brown. But still, this morning, Black mothers in Mississippi and New York, in Chicago and Los Angeles, in Denver and D.C., in Atlanta and New Orleans, did something of such unfathomable courage that it ought to leave us in awestruck silence. These mamas washed faces, lotioned arms, tied shoes, kissed foreheads, gave hugs, and with steel in their spines, they sent their children out into the world. This is The Takeaway.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. Now, you might not know this about me, or maybe you do. I'm a sucker for books. I just love reading. For the rest of this hour, we're going to spend some time between the pages, thinking about some of the best literary protagonists. And we asked you about this. You told us all about your favorites.
One of my favorite literary protagonists is the character Arturo Bandini, who is the main character in several books by the great underrated author John Fante. Whenever things would finally seem to be going right, he would find a way to foul things up, which is something I can much identify with. This is Chris from Richmond, California.
This is Simon from Brooklyn. My favorite literary protagonist is Winston from 1984, because he was powerless against the forces of propaganda and Big Brother, just like everyone today.
Hi, I am Susan Brewer from Camden, South Carolina, and I'm an English teacher who gets to read for a living. As a result, I've found many compelling characters through the decades, but I recently discovered Kaya from Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owen. She is an unbelievably strong woman child who's learned to cope with and even begin to love the situation she inherits when she's left alone in the North Carolina coastal marsh by her mother. The prose is luscious, and I could sit and read just this book forever until I find the next one.
My favorite literary protagonist is Count Alexander Rostov from Gentleman in Moscow. The grace and creativity he exhibits in the face of his circumstances is unparalleled in art or life. This is Emily from Parsippany, New Jersey.
My name is Jessie, and I'm calling from Morristown, New Jersey. My very favorite literary protagonist is Harry Dresden from the Dresden Files series, written by Jim Butcher. Harry's road has been long and very, very difficult so far. He's lost everything 3 times, and yet he remains a good man. And he's funny, really funny.
I believe my favorite character of any literary piece would be Prince Lev Mishkin from Dostoevsky's The Idiot. He's everything you would want in a human being, and easily underestimated because of his humility and, I guess, well-earned naivete.
Hi, this is Michelle Grotstein calling from Kaneohe, Hawaii. And my favorite literary protagonist is Ebenezer Scrooge. I never tire of the story of redemption. Tiny Tim brings me to tears every time. And the long-suffering Bob Cratchit loved his family so much. And then there was the nephew, who never gave up on his uncle, no matter what. Aloha, have a wonderful day.
15-year-old Caitlin Dechter. It's from a 2009 novel, Wake, by Robert Sawyer, and it's the first in a trilogy. Caitlin was born blind and enters into an experimental medical procedure to regain her sight. Her maturity, comfort with technology, and ability to recognize the complexities in the world are all hallmarks of many digital natives. Those are our citizens who grew up always having electronics and internet connections the world over. Caitlin's skill set is exactly what our world needs. This is Holly Freeman in Portland, Oregon. I listen on OPB.
Hi, this is Austin from Denver, Colorado.
My favorite literary protagonist is Eddie Brock, also known as Venom, from Marvel's Spider-Man universe. He has a great internal dialogue of good versus evil, right and wrong. He seems like a real person with troubles and tough decisions who's bound by his past decisions.
Hi, my name is Kyler Renfro, and I am from Fargo, North Dakota. And my favorite literary protagonist is Babe the Gallant Pig, because I think we need more stories about naive, good soul characters who do not change for the worse to make the plot move forward. I love that he is good and kind the beginning and all the way through the end of the story.
It is always so good to hear from you people. Call us at 877-869-8253 on any topic and be part of our world. Quote, I wanted to write a story about a Black woman who fails a lot. This is what Raven Leilani told the New York Times about her first novel. Luster is the story of Edie, a Black woman in her 20s living in Brooklyn who's making a bit of a mess as she seeks human connection, professional fulfillment, and artistic self-actualization. Edie is indeed a Black woman who fails a lot. But because Leilani does not ask us to adore or reject her Shiro, instead she writes Edie as human, stunningly, recognizably human. I sat down with Raven Leilani to discuss Luster and asked if she would read a passage from the text. The first time she started reading, she flubbed the line a bit.
Sorry, I do that a lot.
But the second reading was perfect.
I've woken up from dreams where my hands are slick with oil and turpentine and lost the inspiration by the time I brushed my teeth. The last time I painted, I was 21. The president was Black. I had more serotonin and I was less afraid of men. Now the cyan and yellow come out hard. I need hot water to make them mix. I work with the paint, let the acrylic dry, and when it isn't right, I rework it again. I remain as faithful as I can to scale. I mix 13 shades of green, 5 shades of purple I don't need. My palette knife breaks in two. When it is almost 5 a.m., I have a passable replication of Eric's face, the slope of his nose in the soft red light of the dash. I rinse my brushes and watch dawn come in its smoky metropolitan form. Somewhere in Essex County, Eric is in bed with his wife. It's not that I want exactly this, to have a husband or a home security system that for the length of our marriage never goes off. It's that there are gray, anonymous hours like this. Hours when I am desperate, when I'm ravenous, when I know how a star becomes a void.
The mistake, the correction, the perfection. Author Raven Leilani is leaving breadcrumbs to the origins of her novel. Joining me now is Raven Leilani to talk through Edie's lyrical, complicated journey of failing, flailing, creating, and consuming. Raven, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So I am struck that the first time that we learn that your protagonist is an artist is when we're actually learning that she isn't making her art or hasn't been making it. Can you tell me about that decision to introduce your the art by talking about not making the art?
That was sort of a core of this project, where I wanted to talk about art making. And in talking about art making, I felt that I had to talk about failure. I felt that I had to talk about doubt, and also what you just mentioned, which is a huge kind of part of making art, which is not making it. I thought it was important to introduce her journey in a way that felt true, especially as it sort of applied to my own life.
So part of what is gripping from the first line of this book is, I've read that you've said that you wanted to write a story about a Black woman who fails a lot. And from the beginning, we get that this is going to be a very imperfect Shiro for us in this text. Talk to me about what attracts you to exploring kind of Black girl stumbles instead of Black girl magic.
Yes. I mean, I feel like the stumbles are also part of the magic. And for me, you know, as I started this project, as a sort of imperfect Black woman myself, I wanted to commit that, you know, that reality to the page. I thought it was important because I do think that that dimension of both being human and art making is there's a temptation to neaten it and to make it tidy, and for our heroines to be pristine and to be able to kind of neatly chart their moral allegiance differences. But for me, I wanted her to have the space to be fallible. You know, that felt freeing to me and necessary. I wanted her to be able to, when she's hurt, you feel that she's hurt. You know, when she's angry, you feel that she's hangry, and that she be able to respond in kind, and that your empathy for her isn't entirely tethered to whether she's behaving well.
I wonder if that pressure is particularly strong for Black Shiros, that the fallibility margin has not been as sort of robust for Black women who are taking up that space on the page.
That's right. And I feel like we have been having, it's sort of been in the ether, you know, when we talk about depictions of women in art and in culture, we talk a lot about their unlikability. And I feel like that conversation is one I've always and often wanted to have around the cultural space that Black women take up, and why I sort of wanted her to be fallible and to be able to make mistakes is I wanted to write against the idea of stoicism. I wanted to write against the idea that to be silent about your pain is virtuous, or that it perhaps would like earn you the benefit of the doubt that you're human. It felt important that she be able to be messy.
And she is messy.
That's human. Yes, yep. She is.
I mean, just to be clear, this isn't just like some like, oh, all humans make mistakes kind of thing. No, like straight up.
Oh, yes.
First pages, right? She is messy.
Yes. And I mean, I should say, like, as a writer, that was like, it was incredibly fun to write. But that too is important, that not every sort of response be necessarily justified by like the infrastructure that is around her that is like both racist and sexist, but also that she have moments where she is quite in the wrong, as we are.
Something about that does feel more human, right? That we don't explain every poor choice, every messy, maybe bad choice is the wrong way to think of it, but every messy decision as being, right, the inevitable outcome of structural racism or of trauma, yes. But that sometimes we're just, right, making a mess and it's not an oil painting.
Yes, 100%. And I think that too, it runs parallel to an artist's journey, at least for me, the idea that it is trial and error, and the idea that the trial and error shouldn't sort of deter you from trying to move forward or from trying to make progress or from trying to make the thing you're trying to make or be the person you're trying to be. But yeah, that it's part of it. So yeah, that was hugely important as I wrote, and also just incredibly fun.
Spending some time with Edie was interesting and fun, but she's very solitary as a character. Why that choice? Is that just how she came to you?
I kind of have to own up to the fact that, like, perhaps the author is showing through the text in this case, because I am a deeply solitary soul myself, and I think I gravitate toward those stories. But I also, in a craft sense, I wanted all the room to be hers. I wanted that, you know, it's in first person present. I wanted the entirety of that landscape to be her interior. But also this story is a story about a person who is, you know, while trying to make art, and I guess they're kind of intertwined, she's trying to survive. She's trying to eat and pay her student loans. And there's a certain kind of emotional bandwidth that frays when you're sort of in the midst of that grind. And so the kind of situation that she's in, the precarity that she is experiencing, almost precludes that emotional engagement, which was something that I absolutely wanted to write toward.
There is a lot of sex.
Yes.
For me, that's an interesting tension, right? This, she's very solitary in some ways, but then like she's not all by herself. There's some very interesting, adventurous, messy, in many different ways of thinking about messy sex going on. Talk to me about how that maybe informs the title of Luster, or just informed the story you wanted to tell us.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, there are a number of kinds of sex in this book, and some of that sex is still quite interior and solitary, even if there's another person in the room. Part of the fun was being able to kind of
show all of those kind of iterations of like emotional engagement. And you're right, it does sort of relate back both the body and like what is carnal, but also with like the act of making art relate back to that title, which took me a long time to find, you know, how to kind of retain that faith in yourself that I'm trying so hard not to use the word luster, you know, how to retain that, you know, that kind of essential want and yearning when you're up against sort of like the sort of hyperbole of the world around you. But, and that hyperbole is in the sex, absolutely. And in those moments, I get to show Edie in her messy way, seeking out intimacy, you know, at the bottom of the sort of the core of this book is, you know, the sort of need to make art and the need to be witnessed, the need to find intimacy. And she attempts to do that through sex. She attempts to do that through her body in a number of different ways, some which are kind of ecstatic and some which are a kind of annihilation. And I wanted to make room for all of those.
As I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, that hunger, as you described in what you read to us, that ravenous feeling, and whether it is a sexual hunger, whether it is, in fact, hunger for food, hunger to create, hunger to be more fully ourselves, that there is maybe nothing that has over which the world has attempted to assert more control than women's hunger, right? I mean, so much of how we can explain all of world history is that. I'll just say that leapt off the page to me. Did you mean to put that in there? Is there something else you want to tell us about hunger?
I absolutely did. I mean, I think that I'm always going to be writing toward that subject in some way. It's something that I've been preoccupied with for a while. And again, that could be, you know, the author in the text as well. You know, I think that in writing toward how to resolve that hunger, if it's a thing that can be resolved, is a question that I've felt personally in my own life, but also a question that keeps coming up when I talk to, you know, friends of mine who are out there trying to carve out a life for themselves. Not just the question of how to satisfy it, but is like the hunger too much? And you said it. I think often the hunger is sort of relegated to the space of too much, especially when the person who is feeling the hunger is a woman, especially when the woman is a Black woman. And so this project was also an attempt to present that hunger without pathology.
Hearing you speak now, it puts into somewhat different focus this line very early on in the novel, where Edie tells us, you know, in a very sort of straightforward way, my salary is very low, I have trouble making friends, and men lose interest in me when I talk. And just that sort of recitation of the things that are presumably meant to make women, you know, if you're not earning a lot and you don't have a crew of friends and men aren't just enraptured of you, that is a failure of womanhood in some core way. And yet she tells us so early on and expects us to continue on the journey with her.
Yes. Well, I mean, that was incredibly important to me. Like that those facts be presented sort of baldly, but also that it be an earnest text. I think one of the my sort of biggest struggles when I come to the page is resisting the urge to hide behind the prose, resisting the urge not to say the difficult thing. And it's difficult to be able to articulate or to have to articulate that you aren't performing in the way that is acceptable, that you need something that you don't quite have and you don't know how to get it. And that I think that to ask for help is one of the hardest things you can do, to say that, to kind of own what would make you feel good, even when you don't have it in the moment, is an extremely vulnerable thing to do. And that too was like truly what was guiding me is, I wanted to be vulnerable. I wanted Edie as a character to be earnest, especially as her sort of like external kind of maintenance doesn't really allow for that, as she sort of moves through the world and calculates, protects herself in the way she has to as a Black woman. So that sort of earnest presentation of the facts, that too was really important.
Earnest, hungry, failing, exquisite. Raven Leilani is the author of Luster. Raven, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. There's lots of ways to reach out to us here at the show. You can call us, for starters, at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. I mean, if you still have letters on your dial pad. Also, if you want to really talk with us, record a voice memo and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Finally, you can just head on over to takeaway.org and click on Contact Us and record your message right there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk with you tomorrow.